headlines. President Joe Biden defends his decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan amid mounting criticism of his handling of the situation in the war-torn country. German Chancellor's party chief says the withdrawal of Western troops from Afghanistan is, quote, the biggest debacle NATO has suffered since its founding. Also, the death toll from the powerful earthquake striking Haiti soars to 1,419, with the number of injured people growing to nearly 7,000. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, U.S. President Joe Biden has defended his decision to withdraw troops from Afghanistan, but acknowledged that the country's mission in Afghanistan made many missteps.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces. That's why we're still there. What's happening now could just as easily happen 5 years ago or 15 years in the future. You have to be honest. Our mission in Afghanistan has taken many missteps, made many missteps over the past two decades.
In a live address, Biden also said the U.S. mission in Afghanistan was never supposed to be a nation building. He said the Afghan government collapsed more quickly than expected. He blamed the Taliban's takeover on Afghan political leaders who fled the country while the army surrendered to the militant group without a fight. Elsewhere in his remarks, Biden warned the Taliban not to disrupt or threaten the evacuation of American diplomats and Afghan translators at Kabul Airport. The U.S. president underlined that the response to any attack would be, quote, swift and forceful. Biden has forced a barrage of criticism over his handling of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Political commentator Frank Emspach says the U.S. approach to fighting the Taliban has been defective all along. Take a listen.
Most people in this country don't think the war was a good idea and want to get out. Now, the Republicans are already attacking him on he didn't do the withdrawal correctly, and it looks like Saigon, and so on and so forth. I don't think that's going to work very well. The fundamental issue is we're getting out. But what is missing from President Biden and almost every single commentator here is that there's a political issue. This is one of the first times that the word civil war has been enunciated by anybody in leadership. In fact, no army can collapse the way the Afghan army did if they actually had anybody in it who believed in fighting for the government. Instead, we have a kleptocracy here, or did, and everybody knew they were getting paid off and the soldiers weren't being paid and so forth. The fact that our method of trying to fight the Taliban was to incite a civil war, it just shows how bankrupt that whole political line was and is, both in Afghanistan and wherever we do it next.
The UN Security Council has called for the establishment of a new government in Afghanistan and urges an immediate end to violence and restoration of security in the country.
We're calling for an immediate end to violence, restoration of security, civil and constitutional order. The Council will be expressing its deep concern about the serious violations in the country of humanitarian law and human rights abuses.
The 15-member council, which met to discuss Afghanistan on Monday, also called for an immediate end to hostilities and human rights abuses. It demanded all parties to allow immediate, safe, and unhindered humanitarian access to the country. The UN Secretary General also expressed similar desires. Antonio Guterres urged all parties, especially the Taliban, to end violence, protect the lives of civilians, and respect international law and human rights. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says the U.S.-led NATO operation in Afghanistan has achieved less than planned.
Was das anbelangt, ist es ja inzwischen.
It is now a given that Al-Qaeda can no longer carry out attacks against the United States from Afghanistan, as they did on September 11, 2001. But everything that has followed has not been as successful and has not been achieved in the way we had planned.
Merkel added that the state of affairs in Afghanistan suggests foreign troops who lost their lives there are like, quote, it was all in vain. She noted that the rapid return of the Taliban to power was particularly dramatic and terrible. Leader of Merkel's party, Armin Laschet, had earlier called the Afghanistan operation the biggest debacle in NATO's history. Meanwhile, British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab said London would use all the means at its disposal to hold the Taliban to account.
We're using our G7 presidency to make very clear to the Taliban that we will hold them to account for their commitment and never to allow Afghanistan to be used as a base for terror, to hold a more inclusive government and to protect the most essential human rights, including respecting the rights of women.
Rob said London is working with its partners to come up with everything that can be applied, even sanctions. French President Emmanuel Macron said Afghanistan should not become the sanctuary of terrorism again. He said the European Union would set up an initiative to thwart a large migrant flow from Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the Russian Foreign Ministry said the situation in Kabul was stabilizing. Russian embassy in Kabul, which unlike many Western countries is up and running, said the situation of Afghan capital is better than under former President Ashraf Ghani. The Taliban have taken control of Afghanistan 20 years after their removal from power by the U.S. and its allies under the pretext of fighting terrorism. The militant group's leader says it is too soon to say how the militants will take over governance. Tamim Nadimi reports from Afghanistan.
Washington's so-called war on terror has failed in Afghanistan as the Taliban are now back after 20 years of fighting against the US-led forces. The militants entered Kabul with facing almost no resistance. Afghan ousted President Ashraf Ghani fled the country, saying he left Afghanistan because he wanted to avoid bloodshed.
I congratulate this great victory on the entire Muslim nation of Afghanistan, particularly the honorable residents of Kabul and our Mujahideen. We didn't expect such a fast victory, but we gained it by the help of God. I also assure all our countrymen of their safety. Don't be scared and resume your normal life.
As facts on the ground show, the Taliban are trying to gain popularity among all as a move to help them strengthen their rule over the country. They say their agenda is to provide security for all Afghans, including women and minorities, who have suffered decades of invasion, war, injustice, and insecurity. The fall of capital Kabul has created a big question in the minds of rural Afghans. That is, how can the Taliban bring unity, improvement, and lasting peace to gain public support in the country?
We are tired of war and ask the Taliban to prove how they are planning to gain people's trust and support the rule over the country.
The fall of Kabul has prompted many Afghans to leave their country for fear of their life. Reports say at least 5 people were killed in the airport as Afghans scrambled to flee. According to eyewitnesses, American troops repeatedly shot in the air to dispel the crowds. Video released on social media showed dozens of people running alongside a U.S. plane as it taxied along the runway before takeoff. Afghanistan's Civil Aviation Authority says that the airspace had been released to the military and advised transit flights to reroute, saying there would be no air traffic control. Most countries have begun to evacuate their citizens, along with diplomatic staff, with the U.S. planning to deploy more troops in Afghanistan to hasten its evacuation. Hundreds of Afghans, including those in possession of visas, have rushed into Kabul International Airport to get a flight and flee the country. This proves that the hope and optimism of Afghans on the fate of their country have smashed due to what most here believe is the outcome of heavy U.S. military presence in the country over the past 2 decades. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The UK Prime Minister is recalling the country's parliament next week to debate the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan precipitated by the withdrawal of British and American troops. While some have called the withdrawal a massive foreign policy disaster, others have described it as a betrayal of the Afghan people. Saeed Fariza has a report from London.
Packing their bags and leaving behind a country laying in ruins. British troops and nationals following their American counterparts out of Afghanistan. Just as it was at the time of the war in 2001, criticism is rife of the so-called cross-Atlantic alliance's handling of the deepening crisis and indeed of the outcome of the 20-year occupation.
This is the biggest betrayal. I know the West have betrayed us in the 90s when we fought against the Soviet Union, you know, when Britain and America brought every terrorist to Afghanistan, including Bin Laden and others. They brought them to Afghanistan and they left them there. When the Russians were defeated, they left and abandoned Afghanistan. And when 9/11 happened, you know, suddenly they realized, you know, there are terrorists in the world. There is a regime called Taliban.
Touted as the war on terror, the military conflict in Afghanistan has cost the UK more than 450 troops and at least £37 billion in taxpayer money, roughly £2,000 per household. As their retreat from Afghanistan descended into a shambles, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called on Parliament to reconvene next week to discuss the situation on the ground. A little too late.
If I were the British, you know, military personnel, I would be suing the British government for sending my kids to Afghanistan. Those who were killed, you know, they should claim compensation from the British government for the betrayal and you know, the chaos and the mayhem and the anarchy they have, brought back to Afghanistan after 20 years of illegal occupation.
It is now the morning after, and Britain and other colonial powers have the task of finding what they call like-minded powers not to recognize the Taliban's rule.
In a matter of weeks, the Afghans, and indeed the rest of the world, woke up to a new reality. The Taliban back in power 20 years after they were toppled by the U.S.-led coalition, handing the U.S., the U.K., and their other NATO allies a humiliating defeat with long-term consequences. Saeed Fariza, London.
Haiti's civil defense authorities say the death toll from Saturday's major earthquake has jumped to over 1,400. Search and rescue operations are underway to find possible survivors of the 7.2 magnitude quake. The operations have become more complicated with the arrival of tropical storm Grace. So far, nearly 7,000 people have been confirmed injured. Hospitals around the epicenter have been overwhelmed. The earthquake hit the west of the country, causing severe damage in at least two cities. Over 37,000 homes have been destroyed. The tremor was felt throughout Haiti and across the Caribbean, including in Cuba and Jamaica. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has hailed as a hopeful start a first round of talks with the country's opposition aimed to settle political and economic problems. Let's take a listen.
It has got off to a successful, hopeful start. We are going to do everything possible, everything impossible, so that the opposition does not kick down the table, so that this time the opposition does not break the path of dialogue.
He was speaking after preliminary meetings in Mexico mediated by Norway. Maduro said the opposition has agreed to put an end to what he called conspiracies and respect Venezuela's independence and peace. He also expressed hope for a direct dialogue with the U.S., saying the return of ambassadors by the U.S. could be on the table during the talks. The lifting of U.S. and Europe sanctions and guarantees for fair elections were among issues discussed in Mexico City. In a joint statement, the two sides agreed to meet again in the first week of September, but didn't disclose the venue. As Palestinian children get back to school with the beginning of new educational year in the Gaza Strip, a number of students have to stay at home because of injuries they sustained during Israel's recent onslaught on the impoverished enclave. Rubal Shabbat has more.
While the new educational year has started in the Gaza Strip, the 9-year-old Mohammed Shaban can't get back to school as he has lost his sight in an Israeli airstrike in Beit Lahia during the latest escalation over the Gaza Strip.
Today was the first day of the new educational year in Gaza, and Mohammed asked me to take him to school. I couldn't tell him that he can't go due to his injury. Mohammed used to do many things before he lost his sight. Now I try to help him play and move, but it is very hard. I remember when they hit our neighboring areas and I couldn't find Mohammed. I went to Gaza's main hospital and found him there. I was terrified because I thought he was killed. Mohammed lost his sight in that airstrike completely.
Mohammed was with his mother buying clothes when the Israeli airplanes hit them, causing his sight loss. He was supposed to return to school and buy a uniform like other children, but due to his injury, he is not attending the new semester as he needs special care.
Mohammed was in the market with his mother to buy clothes for aid when the Israeli airstrike targeted the market. He sustained injury in his eyes. I took him to Egypt to have surgery, but unfortunately, he lost his sight and there is no treatment for him. This is all because of the Israeli crimes against us. Human rights groups should hold the Israeli regime accountable for my son's misery.
During the Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip, more than 200 people were killed, including children and women. Hundreds of children were injured, including many who have lost their body organs, amid the silence of the international community.
During the latest Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip, more than 60 Palestinian children were killed and almost 500 others injured. Israeli regime intends to target children and deprive them of their basic human rights. We call on the international communities to put Israel on the blacklist.
The last thing Mohammed had seen was the Israeli bombing that costed him his sight, depriving him and many other children from returning to school and causing them permanent disabilities. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Greek firefighters scrambled to contain two new wildfires on the outskirts of the capital, throwing all their efforts into saving houses and villages that had been evacuated. A fire south of Athens, fanned by strong winds, spread quickly, forcing the evacuation of at least three villages. Another blaze north of the capital also forced the evacuation of six villages. Hundreds of firefighters, backed by vehicles, helicopters, and planes, are taking part in their efforts to contain the flames. No casualties were reported. The country has witnessed massive wildfires over the past 2 weeks that have ravaged much of the country. The fires prompted forced evacuation of thousands of people, burned houses and vehicles, and destroyed thousands of hectares of land. Well, that does it for this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
DeSantis, the governor of Florida, has outlawed mask requirements in the state and threatened to withhold the salaries of superintendents and county school board members who issue them for students. As infections soar among children, some of the state's biggest school districts vowed to flout the governor's order. We now present you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled, U.S. Republican Leaders Fiddle While COVID Burns Through Their Own Supporters. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The crowd gathered under a tent at the water's edge, their tables decorated with the stars and stripes and checked tablecloths. In their midst, in Austin County, Texas, last Saturday, 7th of August, was the state's governor, Greg Abbott, laughing with delight and playing the fiddle. With the coronavirus roaring through the state and hospitals near breaking point, comparisons with Nero fiddling while Rome burnt were irresistible, although journalist Alicia Grusso pointed out on Twitter, Nero actually enacted sweeping relief effort to try to quell the fire and also offer his people aid in the aftermath, particularly the lower class. So Abbott is somehow worse than a Roman emperor known today as being a psychotic tyrant. But Governor Greg Abbott, who has banned mask requirements, is far from an outlier in a Republican Party which, having long sought to downplay the climate crisis, is now offering a confusing, incoherent, and anti-scientific response to the biggest public health crisis for a century. Some Republican leaders are seeking to support Joe Biden's efforts to beat the pandemic by encouraging the public to get vaccinated as soon as possible. But others are actively trying to undermine the president's offensive by embracing what critics regard as a lethal mix of ignorance, irrationality, and nihilism. These Republicans seem intent on scoring political points by appealing to a pandemic-weary public's yearning to get back to something like normal life. Still enthralled to former President Donald Trump, they fiercely oppose wearing face masks or vaccine mandates by invoking traditional party tenets of individual freedom, personal responsibility, and resisting state interference. With America now averaging about 113,000 cases a day, an increase of nearly 24% from the previous week, and hospitalizations up by 31% from the week before, Republicans stand accused of causing the deaths of their own voters, as the highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus skies through red states where vaccination rates are low. Elaine Kamark, a Democrat who served in the Bill Clinton administration, said bluntly, "They've gone out of their minds. That's just no other way to describe this. This is about the dumbest thing you could imagine, because the only people listening to them are their own voters. So this is the first time I've ever seen a political party advocating things that would harm their voters, maybe even kill their own voters." For 6 months, the vaccine program was an example of American ingenuity, energy, and can-do spirit. But more recently, it has become a yet another case study in the self-inflicted wounds of polarization, reviving a sense of anxiety, uncertainty, and pessimism. In the past week, Florida and Texas, states whose leaders take pride in riding the Biden administration, have accounted for nearly 40% of new hospitalizations across the country. Governor Greg Abbott banned mask mandates, yet pledged to bring extra healthcare workers from out of state and ask hospitals to postpone elective surgeries. The Austin and Dallas independent school districts have said they will defy Governor Greg Abbott's ban and require wearing face masks in schools. Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, has also outlawed mask requirements in the state and threatened to withhold the salaries of superintendents and county school board members who issue them for students. As infections soar among children, some of the state's biggest school districts have vowed to flout the governor's order. Chrissy Noem, the governor of South Dakota, welcomed hundreds of thousands of people to the Sturgis motorcycle rally, where no face masks or vaccines are required, while Henry McMaster, the governor of South Carolina, declared, "Mandating masks is not the answer. Personal responsibility is the answer. Common sense is the answer. And we have an abundance of both in South Carolina." At the White House on Thursday, 12th of August, Joe Biden expressed frustration with governors prolonging the pandemic. He said, "I know there are a lot of people out there trying to turn a public safety measure, that is children wearing masks in school so they can be safe, into a political dispute." He added, "And this isn't about politics, this is about keeping our children safe." Critics say the governors have abandoned the conservative principle that decisions should be made at a local level, but they have support from prominent Republican senators such as Ted Cruz of Texas and Rand Paul of Kentucky. Rand Paul, a licensed physician and senator from Kentucky, urged civil disobedience against coronavirus restrictions, saying in a video, "It's time for us to resist. They can't arrest all of us." He has been banned from YouTube for a week over a post that questioned the efficacy of wearing face masks. President Biden's efforts is also being undercut by prominent conservative media figures, including the Fox News hosts Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham, who have challenged the safety and questioned the effectiveness of the vaccine, as well as online conspiracy theories that falsely suggest that it harms fertility, contains microchips, or even creates vampires. Democrats are dismayed by such willingness to turn even a matter of life and death into a partisan issue. They note that a minority of the population is hampering the entire nation's recovery and needlessly endangering more lives, including the lives of children. Bob Shrum, a Democratic strategist, said, "They share a profound irresponsibility. What they're doing will sicken people and some people will die. In my view, Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott are both doing it for political purposes to satisfy their base. DeSantis, at least, is too smart to not know what he's doing or not know what he should be doing. But that's what we've come to in this country." The resurgent pandemic has also exposed fault lines in the Trump-era Republican Party, a contradiction embodied by the former president himself. Donald Trump continues to trumpet his success in developing the vaccines, and quietly received one in January, yet often seems reluctant to encourage his supporters to follow suit. Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader frequently at odds with Donald Trump, has paid for advertisements in Kentucky, urging his constituents to get vaccinated, citing his own childhood struggle with polio and the decades it took to develop a polio vaccine. Kay Ivey, the governor of Alabama, has spoken out about her frustrations with the unvaccinated. She said recently, "Folks supposed to have common sense, but it's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, not the regular folks." She added, "It's the unvaccinated folks that are letting us down." Asa Hutchinson, the governor of Arkansas, has admitted that he regretted signing a ban on mask mandates in schools and asked the state legislature to reverse the decision. He said, "I signed it for those reasons that our cases were at a low point." He added, "Everything has changed now, and yes, in hindsight, I wish that it had not become law." Sarah Sanders, a former White House press secretary who's running for Arkansas governor, published an opinion column about why she decided to get vaccinated, citing Donald Trump and his family's own shots as one reason. "If getting vaccinated was safe enough for them, I felt it was safe enough for me. But stopped short of telling others to do likewise, advising, pray about it, discuss it with your family and your doctor." Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott are both facing re-election contests in 2022. And seen as potential presidential contenders in 2024, which might help explain why their responses are targeted at the Trump base, while Asa Hutchinson and Kay Ivey are more pragmatic. Other Republicans have an eye on next year's congressional midterm elections, which they hope to turn into a protest vote against Joe Biden. Joe Walsh, a former Republican congressman turned Trump critic and radio host, says, "It's where their votes are. I interact with the Republican base every day. They're still highly skeptical or resistant to vaccines. They're up in arms against any sort of wearing face masks and mask mandates. So I hear that every day from the base. If I'm hearing that, then you know these Republican office holders are hearing that as well. So they're just going to cater to that." ask why voters feel this way, Joe Walsh said. They're predisposed to believe a lot of this, but it's also said to them every day by people like Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham and Talk Radio, the world I come from. Like Republicans, elected officials, they know where their audience is, so they feel this every day, and they feel it every day, so they bounce back off each other. Joe Walsh noted, look, typically midterm elections are all about turnout, and if Republican elected officials go squishy on wearing face masks and even vaccines, people are not going to come out and vote, so they can't do that. But Michael Steele, a former chairman of the Republican National Committee, argued that such a strategy will prove counterproductive in the long term. Michael Steele said, never before in history of our country, where we've had to confront national crises, have elected officials behave so badly, so disingenuously, and with so much disregard for the safety and security of the American people.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody, and here is a wise statement to contemplate upon from Imam Hussein, peace upon him, prior to his martyrdom, while addressing the people of feeble faith who go back on their words. You are missing your chances and losing your lot. The one who breaks his oath, breaks it at his own peril. Allah will certainly compensate me if you leave me.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you, as usual, from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us again. Our topic today is a continuation of the previous program topic of cursing, the use of curses in the ziyarat, in these prayers of salutation to either Allah or imams and so on and forth. We mentioned some few points regarding the topic of cursing. We firstly said that there's a difference between cursing and swearing. Swearing is disencouraged in Islam, but cursing is encouraged. And cursing has been used multiple times by Allah the Exalted himself in the Quran. And we also mentioned that the prophets and the household of the prophet, peace be upon them all, also used to curse the enemies of Allah. And we mentioned that cursing is reserved for those who are deserving of it, and only them. Dear Sheikh, please enlighten us further.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You also mentioned that when it comes to those few people who are, holy personalities for our Sunni brothers and sisters, according to the famous verdict of our greatest scholars, as Shias, we are not allowed to curse them.
And we stress this again for dear listeners.
Exactly. As I mentioned, some people, according to Sunni sources, in some of the narrations, the Holy Prophet has cursed a group of people. For example, those who drink alcohol, those who give and take usury. But in some cases, according to Sunni sources, the Holy Prophet has mentioned some people by name and has cursed them, like Abu Marwan and Marwan ibn Hakam and Hakim ibn al-As. When it comes to Abu Sufyan and his son Muawiyah, according to some narrations in Sunni sources, the Holy Prophet has cursed these two people as well. Now, our Sunni brothers' view regarding Muawiyah is different. Some of them, they also take him as a holy personality, but not as holy as the first three caliphs.
Right.
But some of them, they know about the crimes committed by Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan. So there are differences of ideas among the Sunnis as well. But interestingly, according to some narrations, these two people, Abu Sufyan and his son Muawiyah, has been cursed by the Prophet. In one narration, a person named Ali ibn Akmar, he says that we asked Abdullah ibn Umar to tell us a narration from the Prophet. And he said that once three people came, were going toward the Prophet. One of them was Abu Sufyan riding, maybe a camel. Muawiyah was in front of him, walking, and his brother was behind them, also walking. And the Holy Prophet said, Allahumma al'an al-qa'id wa-sa'iq wa-raqib. Oh Allah, curse the one who is in front, who is behind, and the one who is riding.
So all three of them
all three
cursed.
Of them. So people were surprised and said that, Anta sami'ta Rasulullah, did you really hear the Holy Prophet saying that? He said, yes. And qala na'am, he said, yes. Abdullah ibn Umar in another narration says that the Holy Prophet, on the day of the Battle of Uhud, he said, Allahumma al'an Abu Sufyan. Oh Allah, curse Abu Sufyan. Bara ibn Azib is quoted as saying that once Abu Sufyan and his son Muawiyah were going toward the Prophet, the Holy Prophet said, Allahumma al'an at-tabi'a wal-matbu'a. Oh Allah, curse the one who is in front and the one who is following him. When it comes to, because sometimes, some of the Sunnis, they accuse Shia of, cursing some of the companions of the Prophet. The fact is that when we refer to the Sunni sources, we see that the companions of the Prophet, which according to Sunnis, all of them they are righteous, they used to curse each other too.
So the righteous companions who are righteous curse each other as well?
Yeah, a righteous companion curses another righteous companion, and this is interesting. For example, Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr, who is one of the companions of the Prophet, in a letter to Muawiyah, he curses Muawiyah and his father. He says, "Antal la'in ibn al-la'in." We are talking about the son of the first caliph, Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr. And addressing Muawiyah, he says that you are cursed, son of the cursed. That is Abu
Sufyan. That's quite a big curse for those who do not understand Arabic.
Yeah. لم تزل أنت وأبوك تبغيان لرسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم القوائل وتجهدان في إطفاء نور الله. O Muawiyah, you and your father, you were trying your best to,
distinguish the light of Allah.
Distinguish the light of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's been mentioned about a person called Nu'man or Nu'iman that he was used to drink alcohol. And he was also one of the companions of the Prophet. فَقَالَ بَعْضُ الصَّحَابَةِ لَعَنَهُ اللَّهُ مَا أَكْثَرَ مَا يُؤْتَى بِهِ. So it happened at the time of the Prophet, according to Sunni criteria, he is a companion of the Prophet, but he used to drink alcohol. So, and in different cases, he was punished for that. And in a session, some of the companions of the Prophet, they said, لَعَنَهُ اللَّهُ, may Allah's curse be upon him. In the story, in the event, in the Battle of Siffin, we know that we had the event of hakamiyya or arbitration, and how Abu Musa Ash'ari, the so-called representative of Imam Ali al-Salam, was deceived by Amr ibn al-As. And then Abu Musa Ash'ari told Amr ibn al-As that لَعَنَكَ اللَّهُ فَإِنَّ مَثَلَكَ كَمَثَلِ الْكَلْبِ إِنْ تَحْمِلْ عَلَيْهِ يَلْهَثْ أَوْ تَتْرُكُ يَلْهَثْ. May Allah's curse be upon you, you are like a dog, which is mentioned in the Quran.
Right.
And also, we have two people who are highly regarded by our Sunni brothers. One of them is the second caliph, Umar ibn al-Khattab, and the other one is Khalid ibn al-Walid. But we know that in a shameful event, Khalid ibn al-Walid killed a righteous person called Malik ibn al-Nawayra. It's a very shameful story about Khalid ibn al-Walid. According to the Sunni sources, Umar ibn al-Khattab cursed Khalid ibn al-Walid for killing Malik ibn al-Nawayra. Now, this is the question. You, as Sunnis, believe in these two people as righteous, and one of them is cursing the other. So how come both of them can be?
There's a paradox here. Yeah. They cannot both be righteous if they are cursing at each other.
Exactly. Now, after, this introduction, now we come to the ziyarat of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and the people who are cursed in this ziyarat, for example, ziyarat of Ashura. We read in a part of ziyarat Ashura that فَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ أُمَّةً أَسْرَسَتْ أَسَازَ الظُّلْمِ وَالْجَوْرِ عَلَيْكُمْ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ. We are killing those people who oppressed Ahlul Bayt. Now, this is a question.
You're cursing them.
We are cursing those people who oppress the Ahlul Bayt. Ahlul Bayt, according to chapter Ahzab, verse 33, are purified and from any impurity. There are many narrations in Sunni sources about the virtues of the Ahlul Bayt. The Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, according to Sahih Sitta, after me, I'm leaving behind two precious things, the Book of God and my Ahlul Bayt. So we are cursing those people who oppress the Ahlul Bayt. Now, this is a question, what is wrong with that? When it comes to those people who killed Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, I would like to share some narrations from Sunni sources to know that who Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam is. I mean, who are the killers and the murderers of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and to see if we are justified for cursing them or not. There is a famous narration mentioned by many Shia and Sunni scholars. The Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, Al-Hasan wal-Husayn Sayyida Shabab Ahl al-Jannah. Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam are the chiefs of the youth of paradise. So these people have killed the chief of the youth of paradise.
And we should note that this narration, it is mutlaq, it is absolute. There's not a time
exactly.
condition or specific
exactly.
here.
Exactly.
We said that they are, not that they will be or mm-hmm. they were, mm-hmm. they
That's
are.
That's a very good point. Another narration, again mentioned by Sunni scholars, let me just read the translation. Usama ibn Zayd is quoted as saying that, I came to the Prophet one night concerning some need. So the Prophet came out while he was covering up something, and I didn't know what it was. Once I had, he continues the narration and then he says that, I asked the Prophet, what is that you are covering up? The Holy Prophet uncovered it, and I found that it was Hassan and Hussein alayhi salam with the Prophet. The Holy Prophet said, these are my two sons and the sons of my daughter. Allahumma inni uhibbuhuma. O Allah, indeed I love them. Fa ahibbahuma, you love them. Wa ahib man yuhibbuhuma, and love those who love them.
Another clear indicator of the status of the two imams.
Exactly. And another interesting narration quoted by Sunni scholars is that Abdurrahman ibn Abu Nu'm, he narrates that a man from the people of Iraq, he asked Ibn Umar, Abdullah ibn Umar, about the blood of maybe a mosquito or a gnat that gets on the clothes, maybe during the prayer, for example. And Ibn Umar was he became very furious and angry. He said that, look at this man. He asks me about the blood of the mosquito and gnat while they killed the son of the Messenger of Allah. So this is Ibn Umar talking about how great this crime was. وسمعت رسول الله رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم يقول I heard the prophet say إن الحسن والحسين هما ريحانتاي من الدنيا. Hassan and Hussein are my two good smelling flowers in this world.
So all these narrations are pointing to the same thing, the status and how righteous the Imam was, who was murdered, slaughtered even.
Exactly. If I have time, I may share one, two more narrations. Another narration reads that the Holy Prophet was asked, "Ayyu ahl baytika ahabbu ilayk?" Which one of your ahlul bayt, people of your house, are most beloved to you? According to this narration, the Holy Prophet said, "Al Hasan wal Husayn." So these people have killed Imam Al Husayn alayhi salam, who is the most beloved person to our Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. And the last narration that is very interesting is that once the Holy Prophet was giving a sermon to the Muslims, and then Imam al-Hassan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, who were very, young and small children at that time, they came toward the Prophet, but they were, walking and falling down.
Right.
They were not maybe able to walk. According to this narration, فَنَزَلَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ, the Holy Prophet is giving a sermon, but he descended from the pulpit, he hugged them and put them in front of him, and then he said the following. He said that, I saw that these two children of mine, they are walking and they are falling down. فَلَمْ أَصْبِرْ حَتَّى قَتَعْتُ حَدِيثِي وَرَفَعْتُهُمَا. I was not patient to see this scene, to see that they are falling down. So I cut, I stopped my sermon and I went to take them.
How beautiful.
So for falling down, the Holy Prophet is cutting his sermon. And these people, they have martyred Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in that very tragic way.
Are we allowed to curse them? And cursing here, it is actually an expression of our faith.
Mm-hmm.
Cursing the enemies who killed the grandson of the Prophet. And dear listeners, you've heard how important this Imam was. And on that sad and sobering thought, we must end today's program. Dear listeners, I thank you for tuning in, and I thank our dear Sheikh for enlightening us. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except there are scant references in archaeology books. Now scientists have discovered that the giant mammals could walk incredibly long distance. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground in its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. To come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
After an epic 17-month journey that drew international attention, China's famous herd of wandering elephants has finally returned home. Wildlife protection officials said the elephants safely crossed the bridge over the Yuan River to reach their protected habitat. The Asian elephants also received a little encouragement from wildlife rangers to help them get home. Staff used corn trails as bait and built artificial roads to ensure the herd took the right route. The 1,300-kilometer odyssey that began in March captivated audiences with several highlights. One of the highlights was the birth of a calf in November. In June, drone footage was captured of the 14-member herd as they were sleeping outside of a village. The world's oldest wooden boat belonging to Egyptian pharaoh King Khufu has been moved to its new home in a painstaking transfer process. It took 48 hours to move the 20-ton vessel to the Grand Egyptian Museum from the Giza pyramids. It was carefully fixed inside a metal cage and carried on a remote-controlled vehicle. The 4,600-year-old vessel, also known as Solar Boat, was not built to sail through seas. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs commissioned solar boats, which were essentially virtual vessels, to transport them to the afterlife. To fulfill their purpose, they were buried in pits next to royal burial chambers. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain prove that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This time figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Fatik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of Batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now a skillful artist in her workshop who designed colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artisans in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite the tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into an obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment.